This podcast is sponsored by the Music Player Network at musicplayer.com, the premier musician resource for keyboard players and beyond. Since the year 2000, the Music Player Network has been the go-to source for news and views on music technology, playing tips, and gigging help. The Keyboard Corner is one of the longest-running keyboard forums in internet history, with guitar, bass, drum, and numerous recording and music tech forums also on offer. Frequented by weekend warriors, manufacturers' representatives, and professionals alike, MPN provides an invaluable resource for any musician, and it's 100% free to sign up and use. Go to www.musicplayer.com to see for yourself.
Hello and welcome to episode one of the Keyboard Chronicles, a podcast for keyboard players of the gigging variety. I'm your host, David Holloway, and it's a pleasure to be with you for this first episode. For those that haven't listened to our short introductory episode, this podcast is devoted to keyboard players, the gigs they play, and the music they make. We're about sharing stories about life as a keyboard player and the lessons that have been learnt along the way. I'm really excited actually about some of the interviews we've already recorded over the last couple of weeks from a range of musical genres, so never fear, it's not just about rock or jazz or any of that, it's the lot. I'm also excited to be joined in the future by co-hosts, gigging players one and all, to bring their perspective to the interviews that we do. As you heard at the start of the show, our founding sponsor is musicplayer.com, and as a long-time contributor on the Music Player forums, it's great to have them on board, so yeah, thank you musicplayer.com. As I've mentioned, we have some great interviews coming up in the coming weeks and months, and it was difficult to choose which one to kick the podcast off with. I've chosen, though, an interview that sums up beautifully what this podcast is about. The story of how a player becomes a player, what they learn along the way, and the passion they still have for what they do. And no one fits those criteria better than Chris Gallagher, keyboard player with a great band called Man and the Echo. Now, I hadn't actually heard of Band in the Echo until I stumbled across Chris's work in recent months on a Krim R7 user group. And after watching and listening to a handful of songs from Man in the Echo, I was hooked. I think you will be too after you listen to Chris's perspective on playing. And if you do get a chance, check out Man in the Echo at www.manandtheecho.net. Obviously easy to Google as well. But in the meantime, here's the interview with Chris, and I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining us from the UK on a lovely Friday morning.
Yeah, not to worry, mate. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, we're going to talk about your band in a minute, Man in the Echo, but I do want to give you and the band some credit for changing world history, because if anyone that goes to the front page of your website will see that it shows the now UK Prime Minister for the next 5 years behind the driver's wheel of the car on that website. So I'm assuming that you had some influence over this.
Well, it would appear so. I mean, the pomp party, which we've sort of been road testing for a while as a sort of caricature of what's going on, has seemingly taken effect, and we we didn't really want it to, but again, we seem to have predicted it.
Yep.
We're not best pleased.
No, I think you need to own it. You need to own it and somehow capitalize on it.
We're going to get another album out of it, I'm sure. You know, we've got another 5 years to sort of rustle something up, so.
Now, I mean, we'll see. Key question, you know, not that there's an inauguration in the UK, but you get invited to play Boris's big party after he's sworn in. Are you going to do it?
I mean, I'm sure he loves us and would love to be there, but we don't really enjoy playing in cold environments like fridges or, you know, big racist rallies or whatever. So.
Love it.
Mm. We'll see. Maybe. We'll have a meeting.
That's right. So, yeah, very topical. Sorry, I don't usually get that topical, but it was just the timing was too good.
I would have been upset if you hadn't taken the opportunity, to be honest.
That's right. So, I mean, some of our listeners won't have had the pleasure of hearing Man and the Echo. And as I explained in the introduction, I stumbled across you guys via the Krim R7 group and your contributions there. So for those who haven't heard you guys, tell us a little bit about the history of the band.
So we as a four-piece, we've been playing for, I think it's nine years now. We were in a previous guys called Cheap Cuts, and I joined the three lads, Gaz, Fush and Joe, about 8 years ago. And as I say, we were in this outfit called Cheap Cuts, and we did cover stuff and wrote our own tunes. And once I joined in, Gaz's writing style had changed to sort of accommodate a piano player, because they were a little bit moddy at the time. And it was, yeah, we'll throw an organ on it, we'll do a bit of piano, but that's not really me as a player. So the sound started to change a bit as we went along. So we went for a complete revamp about 6 years ago, and Man in the Echo was born. And here we are, just mithering people, and have been for the last couple of years now. So we had our debut album out. I think that came out in 2017. We're recording it for that long, I forget when it came out. But 2017, it landed with 1965 Records, and that was a self-titled debut album. And then we've just recently released Men of the Moment this year, which is our second album, and that's on Still Nil Nil Records, which is our own record label. We've gone it alone.
Nice.
So we're just out there preaching to the people and having a jolly old time, really.
Oh, and that's what it's about. And so, obviously, you mentioned their Cheap Cuts prior to you guys kicking off in your current guys. So, give us a little bit of a potted history of your life as a keys player. Start from the start.
Throughout what is primary school here in Meath, I was always a singer, despite my low, gravelly, snotty voice you can hear today. I had quite a high, sort of choir boy-esque voice, you know, and I used to sing a lot in productions and things. And when I moved into high school, that's when I discovered the piano. And I don't really remember how or why I ended up coming to it. I just did in music lessons. My teacher, Dion Mulvey, spotted that I was playing and taking it on pretty well. So he just started teaching me the basics, really. He would say, well, this is how you form a major scale. This is how you form a minor scale. This is a blues scale. And he'd always show it me in C. And then he would say, now go away and learn it in every other key. And, you know, being sort of 11, 12, you're a sponge, you soak it all up, so you crack on and you do it. And the first tune I learned by ear, because he taught me to play by ear, he'd never tell me what it is, was Booker T and the MGs' Green Onions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, right, it's in F, there's the blues scale, off you pop. I said, we're not going to show me how it is. He says, no, go and listen to it. So I've got a very distinct memory of being up in my father's house in the back room with headphones in on my iPod with Green Onions playing, and I tabbed it note for note, and I still play it today exactly the same. And that just kicked me off then. I just wanted to learn anything and everything. And Keen were pretty massive around that time, 2004, 2005. Right. So yeah, I got quite into them because I thought, oh, it's a piano player, that'll do, you know. And I latched onto them, and I like the tunes, and I still do, really, to be honest. But and then the big turning point was when I heard Dreamer by Supertramp, and it just absolutely blew my mind. I thought, what is this? What is this tune? And then upon going through their back catalogue and seeing Rick Davies as the player he is, I was just blown away then. I thought, yeah, you can have this percussive jazz blues piano in a pop tune, you know, and that just really took me forward. I thought, I've got to learn all this stuff and get around it. And I was just looking at lots of 70s music and players. So Supertramp, Pink Floyd, Alan Parsons Project. Yeah. It was all just taking my fancy. I thought, this is incredible. And I'd just sit in rooms, in the music rooms at the school, just playing and playing and playing hour after hour after hour, until the caretaker, Phil, would kick me out at night time saying, you must go home. But I just wanted to keep playing, you know. And there was the school band, and it's very much a tradition at our high school that the rock band was a big thing, you know, and it had sort of died, but there was a few of us that were playing music, so it was resurrected again. You play at all the functions, and we managed to go to Denmark for a trip and play around there in Aalborg and Esbjerg, did a few gigs out there, and then upon leaving school, it was off to college to study music for 2 years, and that was great. Everyone was just sort of stoned and playing music. It was a lovely environment to be in. There was just constantly music. And my piano tutor hadn't seen a pianist for ages. So he was a bit ropey with, he said, so I'm not going to lie to you, I've not had to do this course for about 5 years now, so you'll have to forgive me. And he said, oh, it's fine. So we kind of went through what I knew and what I could play, and the lessons for 2 years on then were just two upright pianos back to back, playing Herbie Hancock, Oscar Peterson, just jamming away, and we just opened the door and people had come by, people coming for a sing, we'd just keep playing, you know, we'd playing the Doors and obviously Supertramp stuff, because I was absolutely incessant about them. I was in bands from there, but up to there, that's where we are, if I'm not boring you.
No, not at all. And I mean, what stands out to me is that initial piano teacher. Did you say his name was Dion?
Yeah, Dion Mulder, yeah.
So to me, I mean, this might be an Australian perspective, he seems to have been a more non-traditional teacher, as far as we all have that stereotype of the piano teacher as the guy that's guy or girl that's running you through the scales and going through your exam stages or whatever. Mm. Do you feel you would have got to where you were today if you'd had one of those more standardised teachers rather than him was letting you go off and discover on your own?
Well, I wouldn't know really, because I never did it. It was just a case of him sort of saying, I'm trying to really rack in my brains trying to think how I ended up doing it really and being on the piano, because the lessons were just sort of him teaching everybody the basic, you know, you play Fury Lees because it's a laugh, and we'd do a pop song, and the kids would always say, oh, play The Way It Is. Obviously I know it's Bruce Hornsby in the Range, but at the time Tupac had done his cover of it, and you know, people really wanted to hear that, so he would always play it and the class would be very happy, but I'd just be beavering away thinking, this is quite easy, actually, I can do this.
Yeah.
He just came at me and pushed it along. But when I had sort of standardized lessons further on, because they brought a piano tutor in, Mick Fothergill, who did singing with some people, and he got me through my GCSE music, which is a whole other story. But when I was sort of having teaching from him and into college for that matter, I almost struggled, because I'd taught myself weird ways of playing things. Yeah. Like when I was first taught how to appropriately finger a scale, you know, 1-2-3, 1-2-3-4, and going up the major scale, I was like, this is ridiculous, because I'm just going 1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2. He's like, that's ridiculous, you can't do that, you know. And the way I voiced chords and things, he's like, hey, your fingers are all over the place, man. I'm like, yeah, but it's comfortable for me, and I still do it now, you know.
That's right.
Being out on tour recently, I've had people going, god, you play weird, don't you? And I said, yeah, but it's comfortable then, you know, and I can still rip it out, you know. So I wouldn't say I would have benefited any greater than I did from how I've taught myself, really. But certainly I owe a lot to Dion for Mr. Morvey. I can't refer to him as first name, you know, for Dion to have pushed it in me and then get the band going. And he was very supportive through all those years, and I haven't heard of him in a long time, but I'm sure he'd be very happy with where we've got to, I've got to as a musician, I would have thought. Great guy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And speaking of where you got to, so back to Man in the Echo, number one, I assume that's the band names after the Yeats poem, yeah?
That's correct, yeah. That was the one that we put through the Jules Holland Road test and it came out okay. So
nice. as far as, I mean, it's always awful trying to categorise bands by other bands, but, I mean, I'd argue you guys are unique enough that you're sort of this really cool mashup of everything from Madness to The Beautiful South to Elvis Costello to, I don't even know, how would you categorize yourself if you had to?
Well, again, with great difficulty, because we all just come from such different backgrounds musically. We don't quite know what we are. And I think that works because nobody can then say, oh, they can go on a Madness tour, or they can go on this tour, just put you in pigeonhole. And I quite like that, because a lot of people, and they've said it for years when they've listened to us, they go, we don't know what it is, but we like it. And that's quite good. So I kind of push us as sort of saying we're a bit like the Injury and the Blockheads, in that, you know, the music's great, but the lyrics don't really match, you know, in that way. And we're quite, Gaz is very poetic with his lyrics. So I've often said, you know, akin to the Smiths, but I don't like to say that a lot now, because Morris is a massive, massive, massive racist. You know, in that kind of way, I always think we tell a story, and a lot of bands don't do that these days. Nobody's telling the story. They're just sort of going, yeah, I mean, the club's ace, isn't it? But it's always not. But,
and for our non-UK listeners, it's definitely worth a bit of a Google on Ian Dury and the Blockheads. And I only read a detailed article on him in the last couple of months. I had no idea about his sort of upbringing and how he came to where he got where he was. And, yeah, he was a fascinating guy.
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah, I saw the Blockheads recently, and with my father and Chaz Yankel, the guitarist. He he was in the same hotel that we were staying in, me and my dad, and he came down and had a chat with us, and we were outside for a good hour and a half having a chat with him. And, you know, he did say that. He's like, yeah, Ian was weird, man. But, yeah, you know, you just made this music and it was just incredible. Yeah. So you can't fault it. Again, just that mix of Chaz's playing with those acerbic lyrics is just, it's just proper. You know, it really gets me. Really gets me.
No, great stuff. So as I mentioned, we sort of, well, I came across you via the Crewmaster 7 users group. So from what I can tell, I don't know whether it's every gig, but the Crewmaster 7 is part of your rig, yeah?
It is, yeah. It's a new edition, and I bought it ahead of the support tour we did with the Divine Comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Because I did have a Korg SV1, and I still own it, and it's a lovely thing, but the poor girl's battered, and I thought, I felt like I owed it a big tour, but it was so uncomfortable to play. I mean, it's done everything. It's been to Glastonbury with me, the Isle of Wight Festival, several other festivals. It's been a great board, but I mean, I've had to rip it apart so many times to fix the keys, and they're all falling apart and falling in, and it's so, so awful and awkward to play. But it was a very, very good board, the SV1. But I had to look for something that was a bit more easier to move around while on stage, because we had quite a tight turnaround to get off the stage and whatnot. And I just liked the way the SV1 was like a Wurlitzer or a Rhodes. You screw the legs in, you crack on, and I can put something on top of it. So it paid off almost immediately. But it was a gamble, because, as you'll know yourself, as an owner, not many people have them. So I thought, well, I'm taking a risk in getting this round Europe, because there's not going to be much support.
That's right.
For people, if something goes wrong, I can't just, not like a Nord where you can sort of say, oh, this is happening, and some bloke can say, yeah, just do this to the firmware.
Yeah, exactly.
I took a bit of a gamble, but it paid off, man. Only did 27 shows. So,
and reliability. To be brutally honest, if you go on the user group and as a new user, you would think there are some massive, when I say reliability issues, partly software, but also just the pure fact it's a Rode case piano that, I mean, I know when I got my first version, it had been damaged in transit, which is no fault of Crewmaster's whatsoever. But you see lots of those reports, the case is chipped here, or the legs don't screw in properly or whatever. But I'm not seeing it as the majority. And like you, I mean, I don't play that many gigs like you do, but I'm finding it reliable and sounds great.
Hugely. I mean, it went in the back of the van, no problem. We buried it around. Buried it in all the things. So, I mean, I found, although people said the case was flimsy, I did it without a road case, and it's been absolutely fine in the back of the van.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't carry the legs in the unit, because I find that just adds a lot more weight to it. So the legs are separate. The bag for the legs has split on the bottom, so I've got to be, I mean, it's tightened up, so the legs have never fallen out, but that's already been a gaffer tape over the holes job. But I think that, you know, to be fair, it was in and out for almost 27, 29 nights on the road. So I expected there to be some sort of damage, but the case has held up really well. It's not really been a problem. So the concerns of people saying, oh, it'll get damaged in transit, blah, blah, it was actually okay. Not a problem.
And I mean, for me, it was a little bit of a support the underdog as well. I mean, they are a very small company compared to the big guys. And
exactly.
You know, they're matching it in totally the sounds. Agree. They're matching it in the sounds. So it was nice to get behind them.
Definitely. And, you know, I mean, I'm a weird guy, so I don't mind having something that's a bit different as well. And without being too crass, it looks cool as fuck on stage. You know, it looked top. Everybody commented on it.
Yeah.
All the lads from the Divine Comedy was, you know, as soon as it came out, they were like, oh, you've got a Rhodes. Oh, no, hang on. What's this?
Yeah.
They were all marveling at it from the off. And then when they came around to playing it, they were like, God, it does just feel like a Rhodes. It's very nice, you know, and it's pretty with all the lights up. You know, I have some minor foibles with it, but largely I think it was a good gamble for what it's worth, and I've bought it, and it's brilliant. It's done the business for me.
Yeah.
Very happy with it.
Good stuff. And I mean, you mentioned the SV1, so do you remember the first keyboard you actually owned and what it was?
M-Audio ProKeys 88SX was my first one.
Okay.
And I used to carry it on a bus from Partington, where I live in South Manchester, into the centre of Manchester to college. I looked like an idiot with this thing that was bigger than me that I was carrying around on an incredibly busy peak time bus for many days, until the college said, hey, Chris, you want to just leave it? you know, and if you need to take it home, take it home. I said, yeah, do you mind? So But I love that board. Again, that was another thing. You know, 250 quid, I think, it cost someone that wasn't me. It was a good board, man. I enjoyed it with my first band, Spirited Away. You know, it did what I needed. And again, because I was so Wurlitzer obsessed, Wurlitzer electric piano obsessed, I wanted something that had a decent patch on it. And that's, you know, for my budget, actually did a decent job for me. I've still got it, and it's upstairs and it's languishing. And my partner keeps saying, "Why do you keep this? You want to get rid of it?" I go, "No, I can't."
No.
You know, you're attached to these things.
That's right.
Problem is, I'm attached to a lot of things in this house, and looking around, I think I ought to get rid of some bits.
Yeah, that's always a challenge. And I mean, so your rig overall at the moment, Chris, now when you're touring, you go on a tour tomorrow, what's the rig that you are taking out besides the Crewmar?
Excuse me. So I go with the Crewmar 7, and I play a Nord Electro, I'm on a 5 or a 6, 5D, I think it is, 5D. That shows you how much I love it, doesn't it? But that's been a very reliable thing. I mean, you're not going wrong with the Nord, are you?
No,
you know, wood finish, lovely keys. You know, your Hammonds are all there and everything you need, and all your dodgy synths, you know, and it's brilliant. It's been a real wonder. So that's just my setup, those two. We've dabbled with trying to get other things in. You know, maybe a small synth and things like that, but financially it's a bit of a pain, and now I've got this kind of setup, it's not great. In an ideal world, I'd like to take my Wurlitzer out with me and have those three together, you know. But again, I only have to look at my Wurlitzer and the time goes out of tune, so it's like, okay, well, you know, we'll I'll leave you at home, darling, and keep you there. I do take you out for shows, but just the Crewmar and the Nord rig has been really good. I've been really impressed with it, and it's been very nice.
And it sounds like you're not needing to use any sort of automation as far as main stage or other stuff. You're just, you know, switching patches manually between songs, or
that's it. Yeah, yeah. The Nord has that set list function. So I've just messed around with sound, saved them into the system. So the Divine Comedy tour just consisted of me turning a knob.
Yeah.
And bringing, calling the sounds up that are needed, and I edited the Crewmar on Bank 4 to just have the two or three sounds I required from it. And I found it quite durable until it decided to forget one day, overwrote it, which was most upsetting. But I edited it on the fly, and all was good. But yeah, the Nord was certainly durable for gigs. Where were we? I think it was Valencia. The electrics in the building weren't fantastic, and the Crewmar just wasn't for playing. So I had to edit the Nord on the fly. So the whole gig was done on a Yamaha CP70, which I adored. But, you know, I got a lot of looks from the band like, "What's that?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm being electrocuted. So you're going to have to deal with what I'm giving you, you know." So it is what it is. But yeah, just the Nord and the Crewmar come out with me now.
Yeah.
And that's my rig. I'm quite happy with that.
Absolutely.
Very happy with it.
No, absolutely. And so, I mean, as a player, what are some of the biggest lessons you've learned over the years in relation, particularly in relation to gigging? So what are some of the, whether it's rituals you do or just things you've learned, or, you know, to avoid that sort of stuff?
I'm quite miserable, generally. And I've started to translate that onto stage, and people quite like that. You know, I tend to, I mean, you've probably seen from the pictures, and I mean, the profile picture you've probably seen today.
Yeah.
I'm just sat sideways staring people out. And I like that on stage, because people will always look away from me before I look away from them. So I try and find about 6 or 7 people that I can give the eye. And they look, you know, people adore it. They were coming after all the shows sort of saying, "No, you were dead funny. We loved that." So before the show, I just sort of pad about. And, you know, think, "Well, let's get this done then." And that's enough for me to get me in the mood. I haven't really got any rituals. I don't really like to drink before a show, if I can help it. I remember doing one show, leathered, and I'll never do that again. That was years ago. That was a very early lesson, you know what I mean? I thought, no, that'll do. And I think just over years and years of doing rough gigs, you know, not very good gigs, sort of, people in your ear asking for a tune while you're halfway through something and singing it, and you know, bottles coming at you and abuse and this, that and the other, that just makes you sort of learn that when a good gig comes, you appreciate it. So every night we walked out with the Divine Comedy, and I was in this gorgeous theatre in Braga, or at the Hammersmith Apollo in London, you just have to go, right, breathe this in, because I've done 600 terrible gigs. I just try and... You just take each one as it comes, and you kind of make your mind up whether you're going to give the performance of your life, or you're just going to tolerate this and play what you need to play.
That's right.
that's how it is, really.
And God forbid you're back in a covers band tomorrow. I'm interested in the UK. Obviously, in the US, the stereotype is people will scream out Freebird or stuff like that. And in Australia, it'll tend to be things like K-San from Cold Chisel or whatever. What are the UK stereotypes that you cop?
The Killers, Mr. Brightside.
Oh, of course, yeah.
I hate that song. Anything by the Stereophonics, but usually it's Dakota. Again, I hate that song. You know, it's just the outlandish ones. I'm sat there with a piano and I'm playing the Doobie Brothers or some Supertramp or, somebody else, Darker or something like that. And, you know, they'll ask me for something like Mr. Brightside or some other guitar rock tune. And I'm like, honestly, friendly, what do you expect me to do here?
That's right.
You know, what am I going to do? Oh, you can do it, can't you? I'm like, well, no, I can't. I'm not going to either. So, those two are the big hitters. If you find nobody's asked you for that throughout the night, you've not done a good enough job.
There you go.
Or you've done too good a job, which is very far and few between. So, but no, it does happen exactly the same. You know, we all have to go out and play. I'm out again in a couple of weeks, having to just play so I can have a couple of quid. And, you just have to do it, you know, because the business is in a position where you can't make it financially viable
at
the minute, and it's depressing. So, you know, we've come off that Divine Comedy tour and we're all skint, and so is the band. So,
yeah,
I mean, you know, we were all going to do it. Don't get me wrong.
No.
I took a lot of time off work and it was unpaid, and it's hit me again this month, and I've done nothing but weep looking at my payslip, but
that's right.
Got to play the Apollo, man. So
yeah, that's right. But yeah.
Rough with the smooth, yo.
Exactly. Yeah. And what's the one thing you wish you could do better as a player? I mean, there may be more than one, but what's one that you go, geez, I wish I could do that better? There may be none either.
No, there's a lot. I think I'm quite a poor player to how I was a couple of years ago. It's very self-deprecating. But I can play and I can play well, don't get me wrong, but I just wish I could brush up more on the more difficult chords. So when somebody's like, oh, it's just a sharp 5 over a 9, and I'm like, what are you on about? I can make, because again, with teaching myself, I'm almost like a guitarist, piano player, in that I've just remembered shapes.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, I know how to make that shape to make an F7 flat 9, but I can't translate that to an A flat. You know, no. I have to sit and figure it out. So I wish I could do that a bit better, which I'm going to try and do next year. I need to play more full stop, to be honest, but I want to try and do that better. And I was doing a lot of work earlier this year on my left hand. With playing two keyboards, it naturally got stronger because you're splitting your hands further up to try and do an organ on one side and a piano on the other. So I was learning a lot of stride and boogie woogie as best I could. And that's where Neil Sedaka came in, because I saw him live with my grandmother, and she loved it, bless her. And just watching him play at 80-odd with that left hand, so strong, carrying a tune, you know. Love Will Keep Us Together and Breaking Up Is Hard To Do. You're like, this man's a machine, and he can just sit there and kick it out. And that's what I like. So I really picked that up. So if I could brush up more on that, that'd be fabulous. I'm not too bad at it, to be honest, but if I could get more boogie woogie in, then I'd be fairly impressed with myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, get the right hand talking to the left, that'd be better. So we're almost there. But playing on a Wurlitzer, so there's only 64 notes, so I run out. So it's not, not the best thing to practice stride on. Really.
That's gold. And back to that being forced into a cover band, and aside from having to play Mr. Brightside, let's say you could only choose one keyboard, what would you actually choose to be in that covers band that has to cover most things, but you could only choose one?
I mean, I use my rig anyway. So depending on the venue I'm at, I'll take the Crooner if I've got room.
Yeah.
But I'm not really, I don't really like using it because I'm still not that in love with the piano sound.
Yeah.
I like it, don't get me wrong, it's brilliant, but I like a lot of a brighter piano. I like it quite bright, and it's not really kicking out the way I like it. So the Nord just does the business. You know, you're not going far wrong with the Nord Electro.
No.
You've got everything you need.
No, absolutely. But if you could choose from any synth or keyboard in history, you'd still go with that?
I've always been a big advocate of the Wurlitzer electric piano, and even with its fault, if it came with a man that would take the lid off it every day, then it would be that. It would be the Wurlitzer. I'm a big Wurlitzer fan. Yeah, and that's been much to my detriment for a long time. But I'd take the Wurlitzer.
Wurlitzer with a man. That's a good song. Yeah, mate. I think you need to get onto that.
100%, yeah, 100%. Because it needs a man, you know. Yeah. It does, because I don't know what to do with it when it goes wrong. That's why it's got a bit of dust on it at the moment. So, you know, poor thing.
And you've already covered, to some extent, I think, some of your inspirations. But what would be your key inspirations as a keyboard player? I mean, you've rattled off a few great names there.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, Supertramp were really massive for me. I mean, as I say, hearing Dreamer and hearing that whirl, it's just evoked a memory of being in the music room at school, and we had the rancid Yamaha keyboards that had that stupid DJ button on it. I don't know if you've ever seen one of them. DJ, and that's all you did through a class, and you're like, this is... And then, of course, you had the sexy one, which I think was like C, two octaves above middle C, that always went, come on, and that's all you'd hear in the class, and it's... Didn't I? But I remember trying to like search through that looking for a Wurlitzer patch and thinking, I can't find this. There's just all these DX7s and, you know, silly electric piano things. But yeah, Supertramp just did it for me. Once I got round to stuff like Cram the Century, I mean, it never fails to give me goosebumps when I hear that ending. And I got the chance to see Rick Davis in 2010. That was on my 18th birthday. And when I actually saw him live, that was the first time I'd seen a Wurlitzer play live as well. So I was just absolutely beyond myself. And getting to watch him do some of my favourite tunes, Put On Your Old Brown Shoes and Cram the Century and all that. It flattened me. And I thought, yeah, this is where I want to be, man. And I auditioned for college with Rudy and Lithgow, Anthony Lithgow, the chap who interviewed me, who I'm firm friends with now. And, you know, I love him very much. He's been a great help over the years. Recording with the stuff. Yeah, when I played Rudy for him, he just went, well, there's no point carrying on because you've just done a 7-minute tune that has four key changes and five time signature changes. So I think you're in, which was nice. So, he was happy with that. They were certainly influential for me. And I always go back to them. You know, I always go back to Supertramp. I just can't get past them. I love the tunes. They're so well constructed. But in recent years, they're the gentleman's band, Supertramp anyway, but in trying to mature my taste a bit, I'm a great fan of Michael McDonald. I think he's a severely underrated piano player. Again, I saw him last February, and my partner's comment was, "Oh, he's a white man." You know what I mean? And she said, "I can't understand a word he's saying." I said, "I know, it's brilliant." Yeah. But just being able to watch him play, I mean, that's one hell of a player. And I kind of take my inspiration from him these days because I like to be more percussive than just playing a chord. I mean, it breaks my heart, like saying covers bands when you have to just go 1, 6, 2, 5 and just keep going round. It's mind numbing. But when you watch a guy like that just using the piano as a drum, as the percussion instrument it is, just really, really does it for me. I love it. He's been
back out with the Doobie Brothers next year, I believe. I don't know whether they're coming to the UK.
They're not coming to Europe at the minute, but there's still some gaps in the tour, so with any luck, that'd be a riot, just for the crack, really. So you've done it. The problem is all the bands I like, they're all dying. So
yeah,
I'm missing out on a lot of people. But if they come out, I'll definitely be going for that, even if it is a ridiculous amount of money. But then you go into things like Steely Dan and stuff. You know, Donald Fagen, great player. Hate his auto-tune singing at the minute, but he's playing still tip-top. You could go on about players, really, couldn't you? But yeah, those kind of guys really get me. Again, Chaz Yankel from the Blockheads, great piano player. Underrated again, another underrated player. Mickey Gallagher, who plays alongside him, great player. Who else is there? I mean, like the Divine Comedy, Neil Hammond's quite a good piano player. Again, another underrated musician. I try and be as varied as I can and listen to different things. I mean, I'm going back through my jazz phase at the moment, so I'm going back to Oscar Peterson and Herbie and stuff like that, Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea, just because I just like to listen to it and think, you know, if I applied myself, I could be that good. So I like to try and keep it as broad as I can, you know, and listen to as much as I can, despite being, as my friends would tell you, quite a musical snob in that I don't really like anything, but anything that's got that kind of rhythm where it's using the piano in that way, you know, I'm down with. And I suppose, just as the last one, Tim Rice Oxley from Keane, you know, when you're listening to them first tunes, I was like, yeah, okay, this piano's the right way to go. This is right.
Oh, interesting. And when you're playing yourself in Man of the Echo, what are the songs that you're still excited to play and enjoy playing? I mean, you may enjoy them all, but you got some favourites?
Yeah, I've certainly got favourites I like to play. It varies on the night, really, depending on the gig, because it's great to go out and play half an hour with those boys. You know, I love them all very dearly. And a great help to me over the last 12 months. It's just nice to go out and play them tunes with them. I often feel like I'm interloping because it's Gaz and Fush, the bassist and guitarist, the other way around. But they do the writing primarily, but they've always allowed me the freedom to put on what I'd like to. Every now and again, they'll come and say, no, I'd like you to play this. But it's never set in stone. It's sort of, I need you to play it, but just like this. And they'll let me put my own flavour on it and do what I want. But they'll have a lead line, say. Like a lot of the stuff on Men of the Moment, there's a lot of lead lines from synths, which, I freely admit, I'm an analogue man. I'm not mad into oscillators and messing around with stuff like that. So it was a very different way for me to go with this album, and I had to be quite restricted. But, the boys appreciated that I was able to do that for them, because they're not my songs, is how I put it to them. They're not my songs, they're your songs. And if you want me to play on them, I've got to deliver them for you. So, at the minute, trying to think of ones. Again, all of them are great. Certainly off the new album, you get this sort of buzz of excitement that you've got new things. So you're kind of rushing through old stuff so you can get to the newer ones because they're fun to play. But The Girl from Hamburg off the latest album, I really enjoy playing that because it's a bit of a piece I wrote. There's a way I play it through the verse that I wrote, and I kind of reneged on it and said, no, I'm not changing that. I'm keeping that. And I think they let me have that one, which was very kind of them. But I love playing that one. And Operation Margarine's great fun because, again, I'm just playing the piano like a drum. And all of them, but them two always stick out for me. When I see them in the set list, I always think, oh, quite nice one. Looking forward to that.
And it sounds like you're still loving it enough that none of your songs are currently Mr. Brightsides for you when they come up.
No, I mean, I wish they generated the money that
well, that's right.
generates. But none of them have got to that yet. There isn't one that I kind of think I have to get through. No, I'm quite happy just playing them all, and it's nice.
Great.
The reaction from people's always good. So,
and we always do a bit of a cliched final question, and it's the old Desert Island Discs question. And I'm guessing there'll be a Supertramp one in here. So five discs, if you had to choose five.
Ooh, albums or singles.
It could be either. Yeah, either's fine.
Yeah. No, you're going to have to give me restraints or I'll go mad.
All right, let's
we'll go
albums.
For singles.
Oh, okay.
Albums, right.
Yeah, let's go albums.
<Choose one. laughs> Albums, right. Okay, we'll cram the century by Supertramp because it never gets old.
Yep.
I just can't get past it. Every time I listen to it, I always find something new, and that's, 7 or 8 years of listening to it now. So Crown Center would have to go in. It'd have to be a Blockheads album, surely. Probably Do It Yourself, the second one.
Yeah,
I think it was the second album. I'm going to look a fool if that's wrong now. But yeah, because that's got In Between is on it, and I adore that tune. Great piano solo, and just a nice way it's done. Probably Living on the Fault Line, Doobie Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
That's got some nice tunes on it. Now we're struggling. Trying to run it down. I'd probably put the Divine Comedy's one, latest album, Office Politics, in, because it's weird, man, and I love it. Neil played, I don't know if you're familiar with the album, but he played the Synthesizer Service Center Super Summer Sale live every night, and everybody hated it, and I just thought it was hilarious.
Okay.
Have a listen to it and, get back
into
it.
Yeah, I'm a bit of an ignoramus on the Divine Comedy Beyond. I'm aware of three or four of their songs, and I've sadly been in Australia, and I most know them for... What was the song they did?
National Express.
No, the one that was adapted for the TV theme, was it Father Ted or Vicar of Dibley?
Oh, Songs of Love, Father Ted.
I'm really embarrassed to admit that that's how I was introduced to them, but that's how.
I'd get in there, man, and get involved. Again, there's a great lot of tunes there, and the back catalogue's really, really good.
I'll be checking that out.
So, Office Politics, because I just love it. There's some lovely, nice piano tunes on there, and the way he's written some of the songs are really cool.
Great.
Check out the Synthesizer Service Center Super Summer Sale. It's fantastic.
It's just a great title.
Well, it is, and it's a mouthful, and it sang really well. He just put crowds every night were going, what's this?
Yeah.
It was brilliant, really, really brilliant. And I love that in a show when it's awkward. And my last one. Can I cheat and have Supertramp again?
Yeah, of course you can.
Yeah, Breakfast in America, again, another timeless classic.
Nice choice.
That's just got loads of great tunes, and that Wurlitzer is just shown on that album. It's like, here's this mint instrument, here's what it can do, and just another Nervous Wreck, Goodbye Stranger, brilliant Wurlitzer like tunes, and they're just quality. So I would cheat and have another Supertramp one because I'm a little on the spot, and why I didn't expect this question I don't know.
It's all good, but nice choices.
Thank
you, Chris, and obviously I see you guys have some tour dates coming up, UK and Europe, I think it is, in February.
Well, we're in the UK to start with in February. It's our rescheduled tour from October because you know, we had the opportunity to go with the Divine Comedy and a handful of the dates clashed. So we said, right, we'll do it in February. So we're currently covering the UK. So all the big places, Brighton, Glasgow, Manchester, Leeds, Birmingham, London, and whatnot. All the details, manandtheecho.net. And we're hoping to have a go in Europe later in the year. We're just in the initial stages of that because we had quite a good response in France and Germany. So with any luck, we can get out there and just do a couple of dates. And if you're happy to fund us, we'll come to Australia.
Yeah, I was going to say, and I do sympathise that, like, I always go, oh, why can't they come to Australia? But it is a hard issue, particularly, you know, unless you are the Killers, it's hard to fund a tour this far.
Just a small tour. Just a small tour around the UK is enough. And I mean, with us working, as you know, a lot of us work still in the band because you can't make enough money it's difficult to try and say I'd like to disappear for 6 weeks, you know. It was a little bit of a situation trying to get my time off the Divine Comedy tour, but I kind of said, well, I'm either coming back to a disciplinary or a job, so it's your call.
That's right.
Because I'm going. So, but yeah, with any luck, we'll get out to Europe and try and get as close to you as we can.
Yeah, I think you personally should have knocked off Noel Gallagher and the High Flying Birds for the U2 support gig because they were down here during the last few weeks. So
there's another arsehole.
Well, so I agree with you. I agree totally with you. I just think he's the lesser of the two arseholes, though, isn't he? I don't know.
A touch. I mean, you know, it was a 90s man. You know, growing up, I was like, yeah, why should you? Before I cleansed my palate a bit and listened to more rateable things. But, you know, when you look at him now with High Flying Birds, I mean, the first album was okay. But then you're just like, what are you doing, man? What are you doing? And
there
was an interview. Stop it. You know, the fact he did a music video that was in a working man's club, you know, they superimposed him into one of them and you're thinking, you're a closet Tory.
Yeah.
Don't say that, you know, stop it. Well, he's not a closet Tory, he's an out-and-out Tory. I won't get fired up. But,
so what you're saying is he'll be playing at Boris's party.
Oh, he'll be there. Of course he will. Yeah. Dick. Like, he just, there was an interview where they said something like, oh, what would you say to your 90s self if you could go back and meet your 90s self, what would you say? And he was like, oh, yeah, just tell him, you know, keep it on, man. You know, you're going to be writing some good music. I thought, your 90s self would batter you if you could see how you've become. He would batter you. No way.
Oh, Chris, Black, you need your dancing. Own podcast.
I need something next year to do, so I might do.
I think you should. I'll certainly be listening.
We can collaborate. Just ring me up every month and we'll talk about a subject. Eh?
That sounds fine. Good. Chris, you're a legend. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave. Appreciate it.
So there we have it. I hope you enjoyed that interview. And I, for one, am off to revisit some Supertramp and Ian Dury and the Blockheads albums. Next episode, we cross the Atlantic to the west coast of the USA to meet a great player who's worked with some other incredible musicians and learned some great lessons along the way. I'll keep it as mysterious as that at the moment. But also, just a reminder that you can keep in touch via a few means. So our website is www.keyboardchronicles.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/keyboardchronicles or on Twitter at The Keyboard CHR1. If you'd like good old-fashioned email, then don't hesitate to drop us a line either at editor@keyboardchronicles.com. We'd particularly love to hear if you've got a player you've always admired that you would love to see interviewed. Can't guarantee we'll get them, but we'll certainly try. So thanks so much again for listening, and hope to see you back here next episode.